Well, today we are going to end our study on Moses. Some of you are going, whew. Some of you go, oh no, I've really enjoyed this series. I didn't realize it'd been so long. Jacob informed me it's been February is when we started this series. It's the longest series that we've done, but there's a whole lot of stuff on Moses. So we are actually going to finish that up. We'll be starting something brand new next week. But we've been looking at Moses' journey with the Israelites through the wilderness. He's been leading them, the Israelites, from captivity in Egypt to the land of promise. This journey should have only taken a couple of months, but because of the unbelief and disobedience of the people, they were forced to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. None of the adults who left Egypt ever set foot in the promised land, except for Joshua and Caleb. Instead, it was their children and grandchildren that inherited what could have been theirs. I sometimes wonder if God had told Moses at the first encounter at the burning bush that it would take 40 years to get to Canaan. And if Moses had known that after 40 years of putting up with the Israelites' complaints and disobedience, that even he would not actually be able to set foot in that land that God had told him about, I wonder if he would have agreed to lead the Israelites. I mean, when God called him, he probably thought, yeah, this is a quick thing. In fact, he may even thought I could lead him in, and if I want, I can come back to Midian and take care of sheep again. But it took 40 years. Fortunately, he was obedient and put up with all the complaining and the disobedience and the hardships because he knew he was where God had asked him to be. That's the way it is with God's promises. Even though a promise may be given to us individually, we often are not the ones to actually see that promise come to pass. God promised Abraham that he'd become the father of a great nation. He promised him that the land that he was going to lead him to would be his inheritance and belong to his children forever. His family had not even become a nation yet. At Abraham's death, it was just him and Isaac and probably a couple of grandchildren. But the family began to multiply. But by the time they became a nation, they weren't even living in the land that God had promised Abraham would be his forever. They were now living in Egypt. And they stayed in Egypt for 430 years. God promised this land would be theirs. But they're here. God promised Moses that he would be the one to lead the Israelites to the land. He actually led them to the land, to just outside the land. But he himself did not get to go in. God's promises are always true, but sometimes the promise is for us to do the preparatory work so someone else can enjoy the promise. When Jesus left the earth and went back to his Father in heaven, he promised to return for those who believed in him. Many generations have come and gone since that time, and the promise has not been fulfilled. Each generation thought that it would happen in their lifetime, but we're still waiting for the fulfillment of that promise. It is still coming. God's promise is always true. We need to keep preparing for it. We need to keep doing what God asks us to do. And many of us in this room, we might actually see that promise fulfilled. Maybe we won't. But we need to keep believing in it, keep moving forward to it, because God's promises are true. Sometimes, as in the story of the Israelites that we've been following for the past couple months, the reason we don't see the promise ourselves is because of our own choices, our own disobedience. God gave David even a vision of a temple, but God told David, you can't build the temple because you have too much blood on your hands. It's going to be your son that's going to see that. I'm sure that really hurt David to know, hey, I've got these beautiful plans and stuff, but I can't do it. But David still prepared the way for Solomon. He had all the materials ready to go. He had all the blueprints already drawn. So it was easy for his son Solomon to step in and do that. Sometimes it's because of our disobedience, and sometimes it's simply because God's timing is not our timing. We want everything to happen on our timetable, especially when God gives us a promise. We say, I want that promise, and I want it now. And God says, no, I've given you the promise, but it's not time yet. You've got to wait. Even with the promise of the Messiah, the Israelites waited for years and years and years to see that promised Messiah. And we're told that when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son. It had to be the right time. The promise was given here. The right time wasn't until here, but they had to keep preparing. Unfortunately, they had kind of given up and kind of lost sight of the real promise and lost sight of what the prophecy said, so they even missed it when it came to be. because it had been so long. Will we be ready for the ultimate promise of Christ's return? Or will we say, it's not going to happen. My grandparents believed in it. My parents believed in it. It's not really going to happen. We need to always be prepared because God's promises will come to pass. God spoke to Moses from the burning bush. He gave him the vision. For 40 years, Moses did his best to keep that vision alive and play whatever part God gave him to play in fulfilling the vision. But now Moses' part is done. It's time for someone else to pick up the baton and keep moving the vision forward. In Numbers chapter 27, the children of Israel arrive at the border of Canaan for the second time. We studied the passage a couple of weeks ago where Moses and Aaron were told they would not be able to enter the land themselves because they tried to take credit for something that God was doing. God said, unfortunately, now you guys will not be able to enter the land. Aaron has already died. And in verse 12 of chapter 27, Moses is told that even though he will not be allowed to enter the promised land, God says, because of your faithfulness all these years, I'm going to allow you to see the land. So in Numbers chapter 27, starting at verse 12, we read, then the Lord said to Moses, go up this mountain in the Abarim range and see the land that I have given the Israelites. After you have seen it, you too will be gathered to your people, as your brother Aaron was. For when the community rebelled at the waters in the desert of Zin, both of you disobeyed my command to honor me as holy before their eyes. Moses knows that his time is over. The vision that God gave him at the burning bush has not yet been completely fulfilled, but his part of the task is done. Moses realizes the vision was never really his vision in the first place. It was always God's vision. He had just been playing his part in moving that vision forward. In fact, if we look at God's original words to Moses of the burning bush, we read this, and we read it several months ago, but let's read it again. This is what God said to Moses, because sometimes it's easy for us to think, this is my vision, this is my task. No, it's not. It's God's vision, it's God's task. We're just doing the part of it that he asks us to do. So if we go back to Exodus chapter 3, starting verse 7, the Lord said, this is at the burning bush, I, God, have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Sounds like somebody needs to call the exterminator. It has never been his vision. It's been God's vision. The Israelites have never been his people. They're God's people. Moses has simply been the steward or the manager of what God has given him to manage. His part of the job is now done, but God's work is not done. Someone else will need to pick up the torch and run with it. But who is qualified to lead? How will the leader be chosen? Should there be an election by the people? Should those interested in leading fight it out to see who's the strongest? Even though Moses realizes that his time is done, he still has a concern for the people that he's leading. He's not like, whoo, I'm so glad to be out of here. I'm going. It's up to them to see what they're going to do. Moses still says, no, I love these people. I know I can't do it, but I want to make sure that they're taken care of. Moses still believes in the vision. It was God's vision. And just as God gave the vision to him, he knows that God has already chosen someone else to carry the vision forward. So in chapter 27, starting at verse 15, Moses said to the Lord, may the Lord, the God who gives breath to all living things, appoint someone over this community to go out and come in before them, one who will lead them out and bring them in, so the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd. Now, there are three parts to Moses' request that I want to point out this morning. Number one, he wants to make sure that it's God, not men, who choose his successor. Now, I know that all of us would say that's what we want too. We all want God to pick our leaders. But when it comes right down to it, how much do we really trust God to make the decision? We want to be involved in the process, don't we? How do we select leaders? It doesn't matter whether we're talking about leaders for a corporation, for our nation, or for our churches. I often wonder how often it's God's choice versus our choice. We asked for a resume. We check references. We do background checks. We do an interview. We start with a big list of candidates and slowly narrow it down to one or two, and then we put it out for a vote of the people. Now, I'm not saying that any of those things are wrong. We're trying to do due diligence. Hopefully, through the whole process, we're seeking God and listening to God's guidance. But anytime humans get involved in the process, there's potential for human error. Even when it comes to selecting pastors or other leaders for our churches, we see this human factor in play. Everybody says they've prayed about it and they've heard God's will. You come to a business meeting, you say, yeah, I prayed about it. I know who God's person is. Well, if we've all heard for God or from God, shouldn't it always be unanimous? Is God like, oh, I don't care, you just pick whoever you want. If we've all really heard from God, so even though we say we want to hear from God, it's obvious that somebody, of course it can't be me, so it's got to be you. It's obvious that somebody's not really hearing from God. If we really trusted God, we'd probably do it more like they did it in the book of Acts when they're trying to find somebody to be the 12th apostle to replace Judas Iscariot. Now, they did come up with two. They had some certain requirements. It had to be somebody who had been with them the whole time through the whole ministry of Jesus, so they kind of understood what was going on. But they had two names, and they didn't put it up for a vote of the people. They said, okay, God, we're going to draw straws, and whoever gets the short straw, they're the ones you've chosen. They prayed about it, said, God, it's in your hands. Do we trust God enough to be in charge of that process? It wasn't a democratic process. It wasn't a let's vote and see who. It's God. Who do you want? Who do you select? But sometimes I wonder, do we really trust God to make that decision? Now, I'm not saying any of those things are wrong. They're actually probably good. But it's obvious that sometimes we don't all have the mind of God. Even great men of God struggle with putting their ideologies aside and relying fully on God. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, God sent the prophet Samuel, great godly man, to the house of Jesse to find the new king from Israel. Now God said, this is where you're going. You're going to this city, you're going to this household, and you're going to pick one of Jesse's sons. So Samuel thought, okay, the rest of the process is up to me. I'm going to go, and out of Jesse's sons, I'm going to get to select which one's going to lead the nation. But every time he chose one of them, he chose the one that looked the best in his eyes, the biggest, the strongest, the most kingly looking man. And God said, nope, that's not the one. He said, okay, well, where's my second choice? Nope, God said, that's not it either. He kept going down. And the one that actually God had chosen was not one that even their own father would have chosen. He wasn't even a man yet. He was still a kid. All he knew how to do was take care of sheep. How is he going to lead a nation? Well, kind of sounds like Moses, doesn't it? Moses was a shepherd and led a nation. Our choice, what we think should happen, is usually not what God chooses. In fact, if you look at any of the people in the Bible that God chose as leaders, even the disciples that Jesus picked while he was here, very few of them would have made the cut by human standards. None of them would have made it to the vote of the people. Their resumes did not look impressive enough for us to think they should be leaders. And yet God said, I choose you. Because God doesn't see what we see. God doesn't see what's visible to the human eye. He doesn't see what shows up on a resume. God sees what's on the inside. God sees what's in the heart. And that's what he said to Samuel. He said, man looks at the outward appearance, but I look at the heart. So Moses said, you know, God, I could give you a list of candidates and choose from those, but I'm not going to do that. I want it to be your choice. You choose who it will be. The second thing Moses asked for is a successor that will seek God first and always lead according to God's direction. Now, Moses knew firsthand that the people are always going to have their agenda. The people are always going to have the things that they want. And Moses had to learn to always take it to God and say, God, this is what the people want, but what do you want? And he wanted to make sure that his successor would do the same thing, not just listen to the will of the people, but listen to what God wants. He said, I want someone who will go out and come in before them, one who will lead them out and bring them in. It's not up to them. It's up to the leader as he's heard from God. He's going to lead them where God tells him to go. For 40 years, Moses has been seeking God for every decision. When there's a problem, he seeks God. When he needs an answer, he seeks God. Although there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors, human counselors can lead us astray. A great leader needs to listen to God before they listen to men, even if men don't like it. The third thing that Moses asked for, he said, I want a successor that will have a shepherd's heart. Moses had been a shepherd for 40 years prior to becoming the leader of God's people. As a shepherd, his first responsibility was to the owner of the sheep. He understood that. When he was in Midian, his father-in-law was the owner of the sheep. Moses was simply taking care of the sheep for his father-in-law. Now, for the past 40 years, he's been taking care of God's sheep, God's people, the Israelites. But he still realizes, I don't own the sheep. I am simply the shepherd that's taking care of them. God's the proper owner. He said, I want to make sure that whoever comes after me also has a responsibility first to the great shepherd, to the owner, but secondly has a genuine concern for the sheep. A good shepherd has a genuine love and concern for the flock that he's taking care of. Moses said, I don't want somebody who's simply looking for a title. I don't want somebody who just wants those letters, whatever they may be, before their name. I want somebody that's not there just for a job. I want somebody that is there because they love God and they love people. They love the people that God has given them to lead. Moses didn't beg God to let one of his sons be king, or be not king, but the leader. That's what we like to do. When it's time for us to go, we all hope that our son will take over for us. God, I've got several sons here. Choose which one of my sons you want to lead. Let's keep it in the family. Moses didn't come to God and say, okay, God, I've been carrying around this short list in my pocket. I've been watching the people for a while, and I've got this list of five names. Maybe it would have only been two. Maybe it would have only been Joshua and Caleb because they were kind of the only two left. But he didn't come to God and say, okay, God, out of this list, who do you choose? He left it totally to God. Say, God, this needs to be your decision. I want to stay out of it. Simply grant these three things. Make sure it's somebody who listens to you. Make sure it's somebody that has a shepherd's heart. Moses essentially said, God, I've been your faithful servant for the past 40 years. I've done everything you've asked me to do. But if my time is done, I'm more than willing to step aside. Just grant me this one request. Provide someone who will lead the way that I've led. Now, he wasn't asking for somebody to make decisions exactly the way different times call for different decisions. He just wanted somebody who would arrive at those decisions the same way that he did, and someone who would put God and the people ahead of their own agenda. Provide someone who will care for them the way that I have. And God already had just the right person picked out for the job. God didn't say, well, let me think about this for a little bit. Let me go back and check some resumes. Let me see who might even be interested in the job. God didn't do that. God already knew who was supposed to be. He just said, I'm glad you asked, Moses, because I've already gotten that taken care of. In verse 18, it says, take Joshua, son of Nun. Now, I don't think his mom was a nun. Take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the spirit of leadership, and lay your hand on him. Have him stand before Eleazar the priest and the entire assembly and commission him in their presence. Notice that God said Joshua had the spirit of leadership. Where did that spirit of leadership come from? It came from God. God had already placed it inside of Joshua. There are people who will tell you that anyone can be a leader. I've gone to leadership seminars, and I've read leadership books, and they kind of give the impression that anybody who reads this book or anybody who goes this thing and learns these principles, if you'll just learn the leadership principles, you can be a great leader. I don't agree with that. I believe you can improve your leadership skills, but I believe leadership starts with the gift of leadership. Everyone in this room is not called out to be a leader. God has not appointed some of you to be a leader. God has not called some of you to be a pastor or even the president or vice president of a great corporation. That's not the role that God has given you to play. It starts with first having God's gifting, the spirit of leadership put in your life. If everyone was a leader, there wouldn't be any followers. And if there weren't any followers, there'd be no need for leaders. So some of you need to be followers and quit trying to be leaders. And in saying all that, I'm not implying that leaders are more important than followers. Each of us have different gifts and abilities. It takes all those gifts and abilities working together to accomplish great things. One of the things that leaders are good at is recognizing the talents and abilities that others have and motivating them to use those gifts and talents for the common good of the corporation or the organization. A leader is kind of like the conductor of an orchestra. Their job is to get all of the instruments to play the right notes at the right time so that together they can make beautiful music. You can't have an orchestra with just the conductor. You can't have an orchestra with just the violin or with just the trumpet or whatever. I mean, you could have still a song, but it's not the same as when they all come together. But somebody has to direct all that. And really, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, because I spent time conducting. In my younger years, I was studying to be I thought I was going to be a music minister, and look where I'm at. So I did a lot with orchestras, the bands, and you know, the music that the conductor has is a thick thing. You know, the individual instruments, they only have their part, and it's, you know, maybe two or three pages. The conductor has this big thing, and there's all these, you know, you got the trumpets and the trombones and the clarinets and the violins and the cellos and all these things. Listen, you've got to be looking at all of them at the same time, and you're trying to interpret what did the writer of this piece, the person that composed this piece, what did they have in mind? What did they want this to sound like? And then you're trying to interpret that from this thing, and then getting everybody to play their part at the right time so that it comes out sounding like what it was supposed to sound like. And that's kind of the leader's job, especially when we're talking in a Christian organization or in a church or something, is listening to God. He's the composer. He's the one writing the music. It's listening to him and then say, okay, now to do that, what do I have here? Who do I have? How can I get them to each play their part so that this can all sound and all look like what you wanted it to look like? Putting someone in a position of leadership doesn't automatically make them a leader. I'm going to give you the title. You're now a leader, so lead. At least it won't make them a good leader. It might make them a leader, and they may take advantage of that and lead, but the question is, where are they going to lead? Good leaders know where to lead, and they're going to lead according to God's plan. Out of the millions of Israelites, why did God choose Joshua? He had at least a million. Some people say up to 2.5 million of them at this time. Why did he pick Joshua out of the 2.5 million Israelites? I think the answer can be found by going back to Exodus chapter 33. In Exodus chapter 33, starting at verse 7, we read this. We talked this a few weeks ago when we talked about the tabernacle that Moses set up. It says, now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp, some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. This was prior to the tabernacle. The tabernacle God hadn't built replaced this tent. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, he's going out to meet with God. Anyone inquiring of the Lord could go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. Whenever Moses went to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrance to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. And as Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance. That pillar of cloud was the presence of God. Just like we sang this morning, sang a prayer basically. Holy Spirit, come and fill this place. God's presence would fill that place. The pillar of cloud would come and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. And whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, they all stood and worshiped, each at the entrance to their tent. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. Now, this is the part I want you to key in on. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. He would go with Moses to the tent. He'd be there with Moses while Moses was talking to God. But Moses, as the leader, had to go and lead. He couldn't stay there all the time. Unfortunately, there were tasks he had to do, so he had to go do his job. But Joshua said, you know what? I can just stay here and I can talk to God all night if I want to. Joshua had learned to talk to God. He learned to seek God's will. He learned to seek God's face. Joshua, at the time of the story we're reading today, had been assisting Moses for 40 years. It said he was Moses' young aide. Moses asked God to provide someone who would care for the Israelites the same way that he had. Joshua knew Moses better than anyone else. If anyone is going to lead like Moses, it would be Joshua. But the biggest reason God chose Joshua, I believe, is because Joshua knew God better than anyone else. Not only had Joshua spent the last 40 years as Moses' aide, he had also spent the last 40 years getting to know God. He would go to the tabernacle every day with Moses to hear from God. He watched how Moses talked to God, and he wanted the same kind of relationship with God that Moses had. Often he would stay longer than Moses. Moses would leave, but Joshua would stay, getting acquainted with God. The best leaders aren't those that study leadership techniques and know how to write a business plan. Now, I don't care if we're talking church or secular or anything. I mean, we could be talking any business. I believe the best leaders in any business are those who learn to talk to God. I believe the best leader for a country is one that learns to talk to God and listen to God. It's not just how long you've been involved in politics or what do you know about national policy. I mean, that's just all good stuff. But unless a leader knows how to hear from God, he's not going to be a great leader. The best leaders aren't those that understand people and know how to motivate them. That all helps. All those things are important. But what it comes down to is, do you know how to hear from God? Especially when it comes to leading God's business, the church. The best leaders realize they're nothing without God, and that ultimately the whole organization belongs to God. So instead of trying to figure out how someone else would do something, say, well, God, this is how that pastor did it, or this is how that church did it. It's, okay, God, I've looked at how all these others do it. There's a lot of different things, and they work. They're all working. But which one is right for this group of people? How am I to lead this group? So once again, Moses did what God instructed him to do. God said, take Joshua, present him to the people, pray over him, anoint him. He will be the new leader. So he presented Joshua to the people as their new leader. In verse 22, we read, Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua, had him stand before Eleazar the priest and the whole assembly. Then he laid hands on him and commissioned him as the Lord had instructed through Moses. Then after giving his final instructions to the people, which actually takes up quite a few chapters, but we're not going to read all those, Moses said farewell, and he climbed to the top of Mount Nebo. And if we jump ahead to Deuteronomy chapter 34, we read this. Then Moses climbed Mount Nebo from the plains of Moab to the top of Pisgah across from Jericho. There the Lord showed him the whole land, from Gilead to Dan, all of Naphtali, the territory of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the Mediterranean Sea, the Negev, and the whole region from the valley of Jericho, the city of palms as far as Zoar. Then the Lord said to him, this is the land that I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, when I said, I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over into it. And Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, as the Lord had said. He, God, buried him in Moab, in the valley opposite Beth Peor, but to this day, no one knows where his grave is. Moses was 120 years old when he died, yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. The Israelites grieved for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days until the time of weeping and mourning was over. Now listen to this. Now Joshua, son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom. He had the spirit of leadership, and along with that came the spirit of wisdom. It says that's because Moses had laid hands on him. Moses had kind of passed it down, kind of passed the mantle, and said, God, give a portion of what you've given me to this man. Joshua was filled with the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid hands on him. So the Israelites listened to him and did what the Lord commanded. They didn't start a rebellion and say, we didn't pick this guy. He wasn't our choice. Instead, they said, okay, this is the man God has chosen. We will follow. Verse 10, since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all those signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his officials and to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. Wow. How would you like to have that on your epitaph? No man has ever known God like this man or woman. This person knew God face to face. This person was a friend of God. I can't imagine a nicer thing to be on my epitaph. I mean, you know, hopefully my kids will want to say something like he was a great father and, you know, that kind of stuff. But it would be better to have this man knew God. It was obvious that he knew God. No one, it says no one had ever risen that knew God like Moses knew God. Moses wasn't a great leader because he studied business in school, although it's believed that he did while he was being educated in Egypt. We talked about that early on. While he was educated in Egypt, he was being trained to be a leader in Egypt. So he took business classes. He had education to be a leader, but that's not what made him a great leader. He wasn't even a great leader because he had natural giftings and abilities. I believe he did. God put those in him. But that wasn't what made him a great leader. The real reason Moses is a great leader was because he knew God. And he listened to God. And what made Moses' successor, Joshua, a great leader was because Joshua had learned to listen to God. Great leaders listen to God before they listen to anybody else. The greatest thing that we can do for our leaders is to pray that they'll hear from God. It's not to start a petition trying to have them removed. It's not to try to convince them that they're doing things wrong. They may be doing things wrong, but you know what? The only person that can really change them is God. And you know what? If we start praying for them, God might reveal to us that we're actually the ones wrong, that they weren't wrong. It was us that was wrong. Because, you know, before we start telling God how to change him and tell God what to have them do, we better make sure that we're properly hearing from God and not getting our humanness in the way. The best thing we can do for our leaders is pray, God, fill them with the spirit of wisdom. God, help them to seek you before they seek anything else. I mean, I'm okay with them reading books. I'm okay with them looking at how other people do things. But God, that's not enough. God, let them hear from you. God, give them time. Don't let them be so overwhelmed with just the business of running the church or the nation or the city or the business or whatever it may be. Free up other things. Bring other people under them. Let them recognize the talents that others have so they can distribute that out to other people to take some of that task stuff away. Because, God, I want them to spend time with you. The most important thing they can do, God, is hear from you. So, God, speak to my leader. And that's why Paul, so many times in his writings, closed his books. If you go back and look at the epistles that Paul wrote, Paul, one of the greatest preachers that ever lived, probably one of the greatest Christians that's ever lived, Paul was constantly telling people, pray for me. Pray for me. And that's my request of you this morning. And I know a lot of you do. A lot of you tell me every week, Pastor, we've been praying for you. Please pray for your pastor. Pray that I'll hear from God, that I'll be able to hear his voice above all the other voices, because there's lots of voices speaking to me. Pray that I'll be able to hear God's voice and lead the way that he wants me to lead, because it's ultimately not my church. It's not even your church. It's his church. And the only way we're going to accomplish what God wants us to accomplish is to listen to the directions that he gives. And that primarily comes through me as the leader. I've got a great board who's great, full of great wisdom. But I even need to make sure that I'm listening to God's voice above their voice. And that's a big responsibility, and I don't take it lightly. So please pray for me that I will be sensitive to the Spirit and hear God clearly. And then just trust that I'm hearing from God and be willing to get in and roll up your sleeves and follow and move the mission forward together. Because I can't fulfill God's mission on my own. I need you guys to help move that forward.